This is Mark Strassman, reporter with Broadband Over Wireless Access World and also Broadband Over Powerline World, and we're about to speak to Jim Baller, who's an attorney. Welcome to both of these telecommunications shows.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
Why don't you start by giving us just a little bit about your background and your current involvement in issues affecting municipal broadband and related telecom subjects?
Well, I've been involved in municipal communications matters for the last decade, representing the American Public Power Association, which is the organization that represents the nation's municipally owned and publicly owned electric utilities. I have also represented many members of APPA and other communities that have been involved in community communications initiatives, fiber, hybrid fiber coax, wireless, and various other kinds of projects.
So you've sort of covered all the technologies and done that within the focus of publicly owned projects and utilities?
That's correct.
Okay. Could you give us a little, again, just a little bit of background in the current state of the situation regarding municipal broadband networking in Pennsylvania in the wake of the passage and signature by the governor of House Bill 30 recently?
Well, this all started with legislation that was intended to address in a negative way the initiative of the borough of Kutztown, Pennsylvania, which built a fiber-to-the-home system a couple of years ago, and Kutztown is currently operating that system successfully. The Pennsylvania law allowed the city of Philadelphia to move forward with its Wi-Fi project, and the city is making plans to do that. And I can't say for sure at this point what other cities in Pennsylvania are doing. I know that there's a lot of thought being given to what the new law means and how it will be implemented.
Now, is this kind of a sort of turning point or pivot point regarding efforts by cities to build wireless or other broadband networks that would be either municipally owned or owned by co-ops or owned in some way by the public versus telcos and cable companies that are very reluctant to see this happen?
No, I don't think it's a turning point. I think that the interest that municipalities have had in providing communication services has grown considerably since the late 1980s when the city of Glasgow, Kentucky formed one of the first advanced communication systems, and over that period of time the number of municipal communication systems has grown. Over the last couple of years, interest in wireless municipal communication systems has grown very rapidly because the cost of providing wireless systems is considerably less than the cost of wired systems for various reasons. And so I think if you're referring to the Battle of Pennsylvania as a turning point, no, I don't think that it is. In addition to that, over the last several years, we have fought battles in state legislatures every year. Some four, five, six, seven states have considered the possibility of enacting barriers of some kind. We have fought those barriers with primarily with great success. Here and there a barrier has been enacted, but this is not something that is entirely new. I think what is new is that the path that the Pennsylvania statute took in its closing stages received a great deal of attention, not just in Pennsylvania and in the United States, but worldwide. And the media across the country has taken an increasingly significant interest in this whole issue, and I'm very glad of that because we as a nation have a great deal to discuss in this area.
Okay, could you, in those six or seven states where these issues have been raised, could you briefly summarize what the alignment of forces is, who's on which side, and what their basic arguments are?
Well, almost universally, the incumbent providers of cable service and telecommunication service are the ones that are promoting the restrictions on municipal entry.
Now, those two groups are essentially at each other's throats in terms of competition for broadband as things now stand, aren't they?
They do oppose one another in a competitive sense. One could also say that the level of service they provide is within a narrow band, and they have sunk into a level of competition that some call coopetition. When one considers the broadband offerings of both the cable industry and the telecommunications industry, the services they're providing are at relatively modest bandwidth rates. Those rates are considerably lower than the experts predict that our country is going to require over the next few years. They're considerably lower than the bandwidth rates that are being made available in many of the other leading countries, and the bandwidths are considerably more expensive than bandwidth that's available in some of the other leading countries.
So you'd say there's a broadband gap between the United States and a lot of other developed countries?
That's correct.
Okay.
And that's widely recognized at this point, including in the last election by, during the last campaign, by both President Bush and Senator Kerry.
Okay, so the cooperation between the telcos and the cable companies on the legislative front is not really in contradistinction to their, what you refer to as not very vigorous competition on the commercial front for broadband customers.
If I understand you correctly, that's right. There is competition in the marketplace at a relatively modest level, but they are unified in the sense that they would prefer not to have additional competition from the public sector.
And what arguments do they raise against that public sector participation?
They raise much the same arguments that have been raised consistently over the last century by private sector entities that have sought to resist municipal services. The arguments are that municipal providers have various advantages over the private sector. They don't have to pay taxes. They don't have to comply with various rules and regulations. They claim that regulators should not compete with the regulated. They point to access to rights of way and other facilities that are available to public entities, and claim that it is discriminatory for the public sector to have these various advantages that the private sector does not have.
And what arguments do the municipalities offer against these claims?
Well, the arguments are that each and every one of the claims is untrue or partially true and misleading. For example, the claim that regulators should not compete with a regulated, in fact, local governments don't regulate telecommunications providers, they don't regulate broadband providers, they do issue cable franchises, but under standards that are governed by federal law. They are prohibited from discriminating in access to rights of way, and on issue after issue in that area, the claims don't hold up.
So in fact, if the FCC wanted to get into the business of providing broadband, some of the arguments might hold more water.
Well, I don't know about that, but I don't believe that there is any prospect of the FCC providing communication services. And in addition to that, every single one of the arguments that the private sector raises have been addressed. There are detailed responses to every one of these arguments. You can go back and look at the journals published a century ago. I could direct you to an issue, for example, of Moody's Magazine of 1906, in which virtually identical arguments were made then in opposition to municipalities providing their own electric utilities.
At least they're consistent.
Well, they are consistent. Those arguments did not work in the electric power area, and our nation has benefited greatly over the last century by municipalities filling service gaps, providing as good, if not better, service than the private sector repeatedly in thousands of communities. Our nation has benefited from that, and I hope that a century from now we'll be able to look back and say that municipal broadband had as much to do with advancing the economics, the economic development, educational opportunity, occupational opportunity, and quality of life of the country as municipal electric utilities had.
So essentially you're making the argument that broadband connectivity has the same position now and the same potential now of improving the situation as electricity did a century ago.
I think that is absolutely correct.
And that it also, and that it should be treated as a utility, in fact, in the same way that electricity has been.
It should be treated as a as essential infrastructure for our country on which so many of our industries and so much of what will be driving our economic vitality over the next few decades will depend. That I think that it is critically important for us to have a national policy that enables us to build the infrastructure that we need, both wireline and wireless, in order to keep our country competitive with the rest of the leading countries in the world.
Okay, speaking of essential infrastructure, as I look outside, I see that there are streets and highways and all kinds of transportation systems that are paid for with taxpayer dollars and used to the private benefit of all citizens, as well as corporations that sell products such as cars and gasoline. Is this a compelling argument in favor of municipal broadband as well?
It certainly is an argument. I think it's just as essential as that. Sometimes the private sector claims that the public should not be supporting broadband projects because not everyone will use the service. Billy Ray, a utility head in Kentucky, likes to say in response to that argument that in his city, not everyone uses every sidewalk, but and that he has yet to see a sidewalk fully pay for itself, and yet it is vital to the character of the city and to the city's economic development and culture for the city to have sidewalks available to all citizens. And I think there is much to be said for the analogy to broadband as well.
In fact, it's a digital sidewalk.
That's for sure. Now, I might add that the there have been several studies recently that have examined the emerging broadband needs of our households and businesses, and these studies have said that over the next few years we're going to be needing vastly more broadband capability. Even average households, let alone advanced households, will need at least 50 megabits per second connectivity, and the more advanced households will need in the vicinity of 100 megabits per second connectivity. To put that in scale, the cable industry is currently offering at the top end connectivity of 5-6 megabits per second under ideal conditions. Most of the cable operators are offering 2 to 3 megabits per second. This is all just downstream, and it's a shared medium, so the more users, the lower the speed goes. The phone industry is currently offering about a megabit per second and a half. That's how puny the cable modem and DSL services are today.
So they're at least an order of magnitude below what they need to be.
That's right. And the expansion plans of the Bells at their best, for example, Bell South and SBC have plans to provide a form of service that has a bandwidth capacity of somewhere in the vicinity of 24 megabits per second, which is less than half or less than a quarter of what some of these experts predict that our households will need. I would add that these experts include experts who have published studies paid for by the Bells themselves. So I think that we very much need a healthy debate about how we're going to get from where we are today to true broadband. And my thinking is that just as our nation required cooperation among the private sector and the public sector to electrify our country as fast as possible, and even then it took decades for that to happen, so too will we need cooperation between the public and the private sector in getting ourselves to true broadband as rapidly as possible. And at a time when people are looking for ways to stimulate the deployment of broadband, true broadband, as fast as possible, it seems to me counterproductive for anyone to stand in the way of municipalities that are ready, willing, and able to contribute to that goal that we have as a nation.
Could you also comment on this? When I look at a company like Verizon, which does tens of billions of dollars worth of business a year, and municipalities, which are generally effectively bankrupt, I'm wondering how substantially the argument is that the municipalities are fearsome competitors that need to be prevented from entering the market.
Well, I wouldn't say that municipalities are fearsome competitors. Certainly, they are serious potential competitors. And Verizon, for all the money, for all the assets that it has, can't bring fiber to the home, can't do high bandwidth broadband everywhere at the same time. Now, I wish Verizon great success in its announced goal of moving toward fiber to the home as rapidly as it can. Its actual plans call for only deployment of a handful of communities in the foreseeable future. Our country has 40,000 cities and towns and other structures that are recognized by the census, and that's a lot to cover with true broadband. And I think that municipalities have an important role to play, an essential role to play, if we are going to move quickly toward big broadband or true broadband, and we need to do that because we can't recover overnight if we lose our economic advantages in a number of industries to our foreign competitors.
Okay, now apart from the legal issues, the financial question still remains. Are you saying that even a company, that while a company is as flush with cash as Verizon or SBC, can't move fast enough, that cash-strapped cities could move if they so choose, to implement a fiber to the home on a broad, on a universal basis?
A private sector provider has a number of goals that the private sector provider must meet. The private sector provider has shareholders. Shareholders expect costs to be covered and profits to be returned over a relatively short period of time, say 3 to 5 years.
And the stock price depends on that.
That's correct.
Right.
Because of that, a private sector provider must look for the most lucrative returns in its footprint. And for a private sector provider to make an investment in communities where population is not as dense as it is in some other communities, it just doesn't make sense across the board. Local governments, on the other hand, which look at projects in the broadband area as infrastructure projects, can afford to invest in the projects in instruments that enable them to produce paybacks over a considerably longer period of time. They don't need to generate profits to return to shareholders. They just need to cover the costs of the infrastructure over that period of time.
So in fact, a private company would want to put its system into places where people are high income and use a lot of broadband and can bear the cost of high levels of service, whereas they're not going to want to put it into economically less advantaged areas, whereas a government can do that, and the return would be as long-term and as general as providing better educational opportunities for a lot of school children who will then be more productive citizens and able to return more value to the community over a longer term without the city having to collect profits in the short term in order to justify the deployment.
That's correct. And let me add to that thought. If a city, for example, builds a communications infrastructure that attracts a private or attracts a business or holds on to a business that would otherwise leave, not only does the local government profit from getting its communication system used, and it earns a fee on that, but to the extent that a business comes into the community, brings new jobs, those jobs generate income, spending power, taxes, the individuals who come in contribute to the vibrance of the community, and so on and so forth. So to a local government considering a communications project, the calculus is completely different from the calculus of a private sector provider that is in it to make revenue at a level that satisfies the requirements of its investors and shareholders.
Again, on the level of analogies with transportation systems, when the railroads came in the 19th century, they made or broke cities that they went through or stopped in. In the 20th century, highways, the National Defense Highway System, interstate highway system, completely changed the economics of many communities, depending on whether they went through them, passed them, stopped, and so on. Are you saying that broadband is essentially the railroad, the highway of the 21st century?
That's correct, and in fact, you will see many of the same communities that were bypassed by railroads or highways now saying that we don't want to be bypassed by the information age. That analogy is one that very frequently is debated as these projects are discussed at the local level.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about technology now rather than economic models. It sounds like you favor fiber to the home as the best way to deliver broadband access. Is that right?
Where it is feasible, where it makes sense, that would be the most desirable technology. Even where it is possible, we are moving toward not a single technology, but technologies working together and in tandem.
For example, fiber and wireless.
Exactly. We used to hear the term HFC, hybrid fiber coaxial, which is still the main technology used by the cable industry. Lately, a term has emerged, HFW, hybrid fiber wireless. Wireless is a very useful technology in providing broadband where it is currently not feasible to run fiber. In addition, wireless has the advantage of mobility that fiber does not have, but in order for wireless to work successfully, it is necessary to carry the signals back and forth from where they're going to the wireless access points, and the two technologies will be working in tandem. Fiber can handle tremendously more information than wireless currently can handle, or because of the law of physics will ever be able to handle over any distance. And so the combination of fiber and wireless is, I believe, the critical combination that will enable us to absorb all of the bandwidth needs that our communities and individuals will require. How we get there, how the combination of technologies works best in individual communities will be a factor that has to be examined on a community-by-community basis.
Okay, another technology that's widely touted recently is broadband over power line. Many cities have public electricity utilities already. What do you see as the role of broadband over power line, both on the technical level and on the ownership question?
Well, technology of broadband over power lines is currently being studied very carefully, both in this country and abroad. There have been very rapid advances in the chipsets that are used to provide the technology that is enabling the bandwidth being offered or possible over power lines to increase very rapidly. The Federal Communications Commission and the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission are very bullish over this technology. Both have said that they view it as being potentially a major competitor to both cable and to telephone industry provided broadband, and the next few years will tell just how big an opportunity that is.
Okay, now before we get to the deployment issues, on the technical side, I've been doing a lot of coverage lately of amateur radio operators who are complaining to the FCC that even the small trials that are being conducted for BPL are interfering seriously with their ability to operate their FCC-licensed amateur radio stations, and that also that shortwave transmissions and reception are seriously downgraded by the presence of BPL, and the FCC apparently has set aside certain spectrum areas that can't be used for BPL because they interfere with airports and federally mandated responsibilities. What's your view on the possible impact of this interference issue on the deployment of broadband over power line?
The Federal Communications Commission, over the course of the last year, has been involved in a rulemaking in which it studied the interference issue very carefully. So has other agencies of the federal government. In October, the Federal Communications Commission concluded that rulemaking by enacting specific rules that deal with the interference issue. In the view of the Federal Communications Commission, the problem is not one that should impede the growth of the broadband over power line alternative. They believe that to the extent that there are interference issues, and in many cases there are not, to the extent that they exist, they are manageable through various techniques that are available to the broadband over power line providers, and the rules specify how that should happen.
Well, the pattern that seems to be emerging, though, is that the amateur radio operators complain to the FCC, and the FCC says, well, you should work it out amongst yourselves, and they try to, and then the BPL operators notch out some frequencies, and then the amateur radio operators say, we're still getting interference, and they complain to the FCC, and the FCC doesn't do anything. As a lawyer, where could that issue go if the FCC doesn't act to the satisfaction of the amateur radio operators?
Well, I assume that the amateur radio operators have opportunities to contest the interference issues or the activities and decisions by the federal communications issue, but I emphasize that from the perspective of the Federal Communications Commission, the complaints by the ham operators and their representatives are significantly less extensive in their actual impact than the ham operators claim them to be.
Okay.
And that to the extent that problems do exist, they are soluble by cooperative efforts by the providers of broadband over power line service and potentially affected radio operators.
So overall, you don't expect the interference issue to itself interfere with a widespread deployment of BPL?
No, I don't.
Okay. We've been talking essentially about the raw internet connectivity. But I'd like you to address the question of what happens if municipalities, once that's set up, either the municipalities themselves or private companies, either large ones or small ones, decide and implement putting voice over IP telephone service over these networks and or add video delivery on top of the basic platform. What is that going to do for legacy phone companies and cable companies that are now the primary source of entertainment programming, although the phone companies apparently are going to try to get into that sector as well?
Well, the cable companies, in the meanwhile, are also working on providing phone service. The vision, ultimately, of the Telecommunications Act of 1996 that there would be substantial competition among all sectors and all business areas is coming closer to realization today than it has ever been. There will certainly be legacy networks that require upgrading, in some cases substantial upgrading. In some cases, the legacy networks will be inadequate to handle the future demands. In particular, high-definition television is the single most bandwidth-intensive application that will cause problems for legacy providers, and that's in part because Americans tend not to have only a single television, but two, three, sometimes four and more, and the bandwidth demands for high-definition television are very large in uncompressed forms. They're themselves close to 20 megabits per second requirements for high-definition television. That can be reduced somewhat by compression, but compression can't occur to any significant extent for real-time live sporting events and other events that individuals who look forward to high-definition television will really want the most. So, yes, we are heading, as I said earlier, to a stage at which our nation is going to need significantly more bandwidth than is currently available, and the big challenge for our country is to get from where we are today to that place where we have the need for that greater bandwidth and supply of infrastructure that will be able to provide it.
So, in fact, in terms of that, are you saying that as phone companies and cable companies converge in providing telephone service, video, and internet connectivity, even with their existing plans and the addition of a, let's say, a fiber wireless hybrid network run by cities, there's going to be plenty of content to fill all three of those conduits?
I think so. There will be, the more infrastructure that exists, the more applications will emerge to take full advantage of it. The more applications there are, the more broadband infrastructure will be needed. It's a sort of a chicken and egg thing.
Well, it's kind of an updated Parkinson's law that content expands to fill available platform space.
And that's certainly happening. And if you look at the developments in other countries where broadband applications are where broadband infrastructure is growing more robust than ours is, at the same time in those countries, there are significant upgrades in the development of applications to use those things. And we are, I believe, definitely going to see those two trends working simultaneously, pushing each other forward.
Okay. Could you address the issue of ownership structure and what you think? You've set out what you believe are the optimal technical solutions here.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think are the best ways or a range of best ways to arrange the cooperation, mutual participation of private companies and municipalities and possibly co-ops consisting of users within a typical city? There may be variations according to various historical and political factors, but as an overall proposition, what do you feel would be the best way to approach the issue of ownership? Should the cities own it? Should they provide a platform and let private companies provide additional services? What do you see in that area as the best way to go?
The question of model, there are so many different models in operation. There are municipally owned and operated systems where municipalities are providing retail services. There are models where municipalities provide wholesale services only. In some cases, they provide a combination of wholesale and retail services. There are strategic partnerships between the public and private sector where the public sector owns some of the infrastructure or all of it, and the private sector provides services, or they share in service delivery. There are cooperatives where the users own the infrastructure. There's any number of models that are possible. In my view, the circumstances in a particular community will usually dictate the best model for that community. There has been considerable debate as to whether municipalities should be permitted to provide competitive services themselves at the retail level over systems that they may provide.
And that's essentially what the bill, House Bill 30 in Pennsylvania addressed.
Not in Pennsylvania, not to that extent. Let me back up.
Okay.
The Pennsylvania law did in fact address retail provision of service. There are other states that have addressed the issue that I'm raising more directly. For example, Utah has adopted a law that contains no restrictions on municipal provision of wholesale service or infrastructure, but does have very significant barriers to the provision of retail service, and the Utah law has spawned a model that has been considered in various other states.
So that means that the municipality would provide the platform, but that private ISPs, either big ones or little ones, would then be able to attach themselves on a wholesale basis to that service, and they would do the billing and they would do the customer support and so on.
Right. That's one possible way to go. Now, what we've seen is that in many places, that kind of model simply is infeasible. There is not, it cannot be justified from an economic standpoint.
What's the problem with it?
There are several problems with it. The main one is that the cost of building the system has to be recouped somehow, and the cost of building the system must then be passed on to the retail providers, and unless there's a large enough market there, there isn't enough money to pay for the system and for the retail providers to come in and sell their services at a competitive level, and so the system won't work unless the municipal provider can itself provide some or all retail services.
Okay, I see that.
There are also feasibility studies suggesting that in some context a wholesale model might actually work, but we have no evidence yet of such models actually working in the field as opposed to on paper.
So what legislation is required in your view to make sure that the better, that there's a wide range of possible structures and that the municipalities are allowed to freely get involved to the extent that they deem necessary?
I would go the other way. I would say that our needs as a nation are so great at this point to find solutions to the need to get ourselves up on a world-class level of broadband deployment at affordable rates, that rather than finding ways to restrict municipal involvement, that what we should be looking for are ways to enhance municipal involvement. I believe that what we should be doing is not enacting new barriers. I believe we should be removing ones that currently exist. I believe that each and every municipal broadband project is the subject of intensive debate at the local level. There is no project that I've ever been associated with in the last decade that has not received a great deal of analysis at the local level on every front, financial, economic, social. These things are debated very carefully, and by the time a local government decides to go forward, the decision makers will have heard the views of all sides many times, and if they decide to go forward with a project, they do so only because it has a high rate of high potential rate of success. It is filling a need that the community believes is not going to be filled by the private sector, and that the incumbent providers of service have not made the case for preventing the project from going forward.
So in fact, what you're saying is that if a municipality politically decides, the decision makers, the council and the mayor and so on, decide to, or a referendum or something, decide to go ahead, that the issue, that the question has received an intense amount of scrutiny, and it has a significant amount of public support in order for it to go ahead.
Exactly.
Okay.
And I think that's enough. And private phone and cable companies participate throughout the process. They have their say. They analyze the figures that the municipal advocates present. The public listens very carefully because they know that the success or failure of the project will have a significant impact on the community. And since it's the community that's really the most deeply interested and the ones that will be the most benefited or harmed depending on the success of the project, I think that we ought to rely on them to make those decisions for themselves and to select among the business models and the technologies and all the things that at a local level should most appropriately be considered and resolved.
Okay, without making it too grandiose, essentially it's a question about whether giant corporations far away or local communities on the ground ought to be making these decisions.
Exactly.
On the question of national interest, the again, going back to the interstate highway system, which was, even though it had all of these tremendous commercial and social effects, it was justified. The billions of dollars of national taxpayer money that were spent to develop it were spent in the name of national security, in the name of national competitiveness in some level. Again, is there an analogy to us, and could a similar argument be made now? I mean, you've been implicitly making it several times, that in order for the United States to remain economically competitive in the world, it needs to have a world-class broadband system, and that alone would justify spending federal money in support of local efforts to deploy broadband everywhere.
I couldn't have said it any better than that. That, in fact, is what a number of other countries are doing. They view broadband as being the key to their economic success and their educational and cultural and other success. We don't. We are engaged in a counterproductive debate on what micro laws should stand in the way of municipal involvement and what shouldn't. In the meanwhile, we are dropping like a stone in global competitiveness. We were third or fourth in the world a few years ago. Now, depending on which study one reads, we are 13th, 14th. And we're losing ground.
And, of course, this is going to have implications down the road for economic possibilities and what can be done in the future in paying off the huge national debt and other macro issues.
Right. And this is not the kind of thing that we can recover from overnight without spending massively more money in some massive campaign to try to catch up, because of the interrelatedness of the economic issues.
And in particular, if these other countries that the United States is competing with can provide state-of-the-art education to their entire population and take full advantage of their ability to be creative in business and science and education and the arts, that's a 20-year process. And if the United States decides in 2020 or 2030 that they ought to catch up with these other countries, they're not going to be able to force feed the education into a whole generation that's been disadvantaged relative to other countries.
That's correct. And as you go industry by industry, this same pattern also has ramifications. If we fall behind in development of electronics or software or computers or various other things, if our processes for making steel and other things that depend on high levels of bandwidth being transferred and information being transferred, if our medical our telework infrastructure is backward relative to other countries, the effects of all these things will definitely not be soluble. We will not be able to turn around on a dime. These things will take time. Our economy is highly interrelated, and we have many needs that can be satisfied only by ramping up our information infrastructure at the same time.
Okay, why don't I let you wrap up by putting forward any ideas that you have as to how the agenda that you've just specified can be brought into greater public awareness, become part of the political debate, and be implemented.
Well, I think that there has been a great increase in discussion as a result of the events in Pennsylvania at the end of last year that I think is very healthy, and I believe that more of that needs to happen. As I see the debates in the major media, the Wall Street Journals, the USA Today's and others, your call to me is a sign that people are noticing and that these are important issues. This was an issue on which there was consensus between the Democrats and the Republicans in the last election, but now we need to move forward more quickly to implementation. The federal communications laws are going to be written. That's a matter of consensus in Washington over the next couple of years. I think it's very useful that this debate is increasing right now as we speak everywhere across the country, and I think that's a good sign.
Okay, and we can use the infrastructure that we've got, the internet. People can now, millions of people can listen to what you just said by coming to broadband wireless access world and listening to what you had to say, and I want to thank you very much for saying it here on our show.
I'm very glad to have had the opportunity, and I thank you for calling.
You're very welcome. Talk to you later.
Okay,
bye-bye.
Bye-bye.